Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, monsters, heroes, and other mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. And we've done it. We've come to the end of another chapter, another season. We've finished up the Japanese mythos section of Deities and Demigods. And by the time you're listening to this, the poll for the new season will be up. So go in and get your vote in. There's not very many chapters remaining. So it's up to you which one we do first. Now, normally in the final episode of a quote-unquote season, I talk about what's missing from this section, but we just had the extra-long Albert Addenda episode, and in that, I feel like we covered most of that ground. We know what's missing from this, I mean, a lot, but sort of the core concept that's missing is Buddhism, the way that Shintoism and Buddhism cross over, and the particular forms that Buddhism takes in Japan. There are a few Buddhist deities in the section, but not as which would represent the cultural influence that Buddhism has had on Japan. So instead, in this episode, I'm just going to give a broader final thoughts discussion. All right, point number one of my end of season thoughts. The structure of this book struggles to deal with real world mythology sometimes. You know, the reality of Japanese mythology is that it's not as separable from Chinese mythology is all that because of the joint importance of Buddhism. And in fact, there's not nearly enough discussion of Buddhism in the Chinese section. And then, of course, some of those Buddhist deities, as we have seen, are adapted into Buddhism from the collection of spiritual traditions that we would today call Hinduism. So that's a whole other thing. And I want to suggest that this is actually the more common condition for religions, that quite a lot of religious practices around the world are quite permeable, that, you know, deities from other cultures are brought in, that beliefs and traditions and customs from other religions, as it were, are brought in, and that people don't really see this as a contradiction. One of the things that I kept running into as I read about Shinto was that people will go and pray at a Shinto shrine, and they'll go and pray at a Buddhist temple, and they'll go to Shinto festivals, and they'll go to Buddhist festivals, and they will not perceive this as a contradiction. And if they don't, who am I to tell them that it is? So in reality, faiths cross over in ways that make it difficult to draw neat boundaries between chapters. And we've already, to some extent, seen this in the Sumerian and Babylonian chapters, where the reality is that there is an ever-evolving set of Mesopotamian myths and religious traditions of which the Sumerian religion and the Babylonian religion are kind of points on that spectrum. But time and again, it seems like we see the author, and for the purposes of this discussion, I think I have to say that the author is Jim Ward, right? Like, the book is credited to Kuntz and Ward, but my understanding is that that's because Kuntz did so much work on, like, previous editions, and this edition is mainly Ward's work. Time and again, we see the author leaving out useful, relevant, game-inspirational material because it doesn't fit into the structure of the book rather than fit the structure to the material. Now, on the other hand, do we maybe have to point the finger at, like, TSR editorial? I don't know who that is at this point, like who's making the decisions. Is it Gary Gygax? But those kinds of structural decisions might very well be made by an editor. And in fact, I recall reading an article by Ward in which he talks about basically being given a stack of forms that were meant to be the structure of this book, right? For each deity, fill in this form, you know, giving all of its stats and things. And if that's what's been determined as the structure of the book, then, you know, maybe there's nothing you can really do about it. But I do think that we can see here the ways in which this structure is maybe not as helpful as it might be, either in providing for something that people can use and play, or in teaching us anything about a real-world religion that I venture to suggest that most of the book's readers in 1980 wouldn't be familiar with. Okay, point two. I don't know that this is a point that I am qualified to discuss, but I also feel like it's a point that I can't really not discuss. So here we go. Is this racist? I don't know, Jim Ward. And I'm not here to accuse anyone of anything. And I don't think that there is any part of the text of this section that suggests that it's motivated by any kind of racial animus. The illustrations, you know, you can see that maybe some people were told, make it look Japanese, and, you know, it didn't come out perfectly. But again, I don't think that it's intended in any way to be hurtful. So in that sense, no. I think we can look at the Japanese section and say, no, it is not racist. But in a broader sense, I think there's a case to be made that is the product of a more pervasive problem with the way that Asian cultures are perceived in the United States and elsewhere. I only say the United States because, you know, that's where the book was written. I think it is interesting to look at the way that Chinese and Japanese sections of this book are handled. They're quite different. The Chinese section is a bunch of garbled nonsense, and the Japanese section is fine as far as it goes, but it has noticeable gaps. And I think that we can attribute this in part to a greater ease of access to sources in some chapters than in others. And that's not Jim Ward's fault at all. That's the product of a pervasive difference of attitude towards Asian cultures as opposed to European cultures. So if you are in, you know, a medium-sized town anywhere in the English-speaking world, like the small Iowa town where Jim Ward was living and working, and you walk into a local bookstore or a public library, I bet that most of the time, you will find it easier to find a good book about Greek mythology or Norse mythology than a book about Shinto or a book about Zen as a religious practice, rather than, say, Zen as a wellness tool. And if you think about it, that's messed up. Take me, for example, if you will. Now, I may be an extreme example, but I think it's fair enough. I am from California, and there were way more kids in my school that came from China or Japan or Korea or Vietnam or whose parents were from those cultures than there were people whose families came from, you know, Denmark or Iceland. But despite the fact that there are many more people whose lives are culturally influenced by traditional Chinese religion or by Shinto in that community, if I were to go into the school library and get out a book on mythology, I bet it would be easier for me to get out a book on Norse mythology than it would be to get out a book on Shinto. And in fact, no, you know what? I did. My whole fascination with the early Middle Ages started when cheesy sci-fi novels pointing me towards the Eddas, and then when I was in the school library, I found the Patricia Terry translation of the Eddas, and then I stole it. I checked that book out, and I never returned it. I lost it at some point, and then I bought another copy, and I lost that. I know it's not the best translation in the world, but it's important to me personally because of, my history with it. But, so, my California public high school had a translation of the Poetic Edda in it, and I bet that's not true of the Nihon Shoki. Maybe it is today, you know, this was 25 years ago. But to a great extent, in terms of, how that material is presented in popular culture, the living religious practice of 100-some-odd million Japanese people is more obscure than the pre-Christian beliefs of a much smaller part of the world 1,000 years ago. Why is this? Well, I think it's because to many white English speakers, Vikings are quote-unquote us in a way that Japanese people are not. People talk about othering particular groups or particular communities. Well, that's the kind of thing they're talking about. That the information that is available to me as a reader sends me the message that I have more in common with a Viking than I do with a modern Japanese person. Now, I'm not suggesting that you should say that, you know, Shinto is necessarily part of quote-unquote your cultural heritage, but it's hard to see how it's less part of your cultural heritage than, the Elder Edda. I mean, you know, unless you're Icelandic or whatever. But so, again, I'm not saying that at any point of this process, anybody is saying, hey, let's exclude Japanese or Japanese American people. I think that everybody is making decisions based on, what they think the readers want to see, and I think that they're probably right. And maybe there are other factors. Again, I don't want to pin it all on this one theory. So for instance, I think that the information for the Chinese section being much worse than for the Japanese section, may have something to do with, the Cold War. I don't know. Or maybe just the vagaries of fate. You know, just, how specific, what texts were specifically available to Ward. And, you know, maybe he just rolled a one on the Chinese section. These things happen. I wonder how the Japanese D&D community responded to this kind of thing, actually. I have no idea. I should try and find out. Again, I don't want to overstate the case. In terms of the social ills of modern society, the slightly different attitudes toward different mythologies in Dungeons & Dragons supplements are very far down the ladder. And again, I certainly don't think anybody was you know, motivated by, like, racial prejudice. Anyway, I guess what I'm saying is that assuming a commitment to a multicultural society, it would be good if that attitude were lessened. Anyway, I am no expert on this topic. I speak subject to correction as always, but that is something that kept kind of niggling in my mind as I was reading this chapter and thinking about the Chinese chapter. And maybe it's just an artifact of the sort of simplistic way that this game presents its chapters in general. But I do think that if you look as a totality at the way D&D talks about Asian cultures, maybe it could use some work. Which is not to say that it's completely worthless. The first place I ever heard about characters of the Romance of the Three Kingdoms was an article in Dragon Magazine giving stats for them. If you are not very well exposed to those cultures, then, you know, gaming is one way that you can learn about them, and that's cool. But to what extent do we trust the authority of the person speaking here? I almost feel some reluctance to speak about these issues. First, because who am I? And secondly, because I feel like there is a temptation when dealing with any issue of this kind, either to say, yes, absolutely, the author was a dirty old racist, and therefore we condemn the author, that dirty old racist, and we're not going to have to think about why things wound up this way in a broader sense. Or alternatively, no, the author is not a racist, and therefore nothing is wrong, and we don't have to think about how things wound up this way in a broader sense. If the goal is to improve either society or gaming books, or both would be nice, maybe the specific question of whether the author is a big old racist is less relevant than what this work tells us about the way that games in general think about these cultures. Anyway, point three, mythology is not religion. One of the things that bugs me the most about this book, that bugs me the most about this section, you know what? I'm going to make a possibly irreverent, possibly irrelevant comparison. So, not that long ago, Chaosium released a new edition of the Malleus Monstrorum, the big monster book for Call of Cthulhu. And I'm probably going to get it at some point since I am, you know, inarguably both a Cthulhu guy and a monster guy. But it is quite expensive, so, you know, I might delay that purchase for a while. Not because times are hard necessarily, but because I did just buy a lot of miniatures for Stargrave. Now, one of the things that Malleus Monstrorum does that I think is great, from, you know, from what I've seen of it, is that it really tries to look at how those deities, how those monsters are going to turn up in play. I'm not saying it's like solely session focused, but it combines, you know, both an Encyclopedic and creative approach to the quote unquote lore, a term I don't like, and thinking about how those ideas translate into the kind of investigative horror that Call of Cthulhu does. That's great, but it's not what the book's ancestors did, because Malleus Monstrorum, the first Malleus Monstrorum, was based on Ye Book of Monstras, parts 1 and 2, a pair of books by Scott and Yalowski for an earlier edition of Call of Cthulhu, maybe 5th, maybe 6th. And Ye Book of Monstras is, it's impressive as a feat of scholarship, but what it does is that it sort of takes the creatures and deities and presents them divorced from the context, right? They've gone through every monster and critter in every story that could conceivably be thought of as Cthulhu mythos, and then just kind of like ripped them out of their context and just given them stats and a very brief description. It has to be very brief because there's a bazillion monsters in this thing. But the result is that kind of a lot of it just comes off as who cares. I'm a big T.E.D. Klein fan, insofar as you can be a big T.E.D. Klein fan. Man, you know, in terms of horror, published a handful of stories and one novel, and they're good, but, you know, it's not a tremendous body of work. He's better known as an editor. But Black Man with a Horn is this, I don't know how to describe it other than kind of sordid. There's something unpleasant about Black Man with a Horn. There's something unpleasant about the narrator. There's something unpleasant about the situations that he finds himself in. I don't remember if it's in Black Man with a Horn or Children of the Kingdom, but there's a bit where the narrator sees like a map that has the "you are here" thing on it, and someone has written "too bad for you" underneath it. And that's kind of how you feel with some of those T.E.D. Klein stories. There's just something gross about them. And the monster, if monster there be, from Black Man with a Horn, is not something that, like, appears on the page and, like, it's not detailed very much, right? It's just this creepy presence. And then to see it as just like Sugaron, avatar of Nyarlathotep, and have it be, you know, just have this stat block, and it's kind of a letdown. Unless you know the context of the story already, there's no point to it. You may be able to perceive the comparison I'm making here, because regardless of how I feel about this section, there is a lot of information in it, which is great. But the majority of that information is junk, which is not great. It is bananas that there are fight stats for kindly old gods of good fortune and minor figures like Tsukuyomi, and nothing that would give you any reason to fight them. For these stat blocks, you could 100% have written a stat block at the beginning of the book that said, you know, major god, medium god, I don't know, lesser god. Here are some basic stats. Here are some ways that you might gussy them up. And then put, like, the little individual abilities, like Amatsumara's smithing roll or whatever, in each entry, and saved maybe a quarter of the book's length. And then maybe put something about the gods' agendas, about their followers, about anything that might make them useful in a game in there. Now again, no, this is anybody's fault. This is just kind of how the structure of the book turned out. But I feel like treating a book of deities like a bestiary rather than like a setting book is maybe not a good approach to take. Doubly so because, as I've said, many readers would be unfamiliar with these figures in their original context. So, like, it's maybe okay to do that with Thor because everybody already knows who Thor is. Even if they only know him from Marvel Comics, whatever, Marvel Comics Thor perfectly fine. Right? It doesn't have to be a real encyclopedia of religion. Actually, mythology is fine, but the form in which most characters would encounter it is religion. So, in the reading that I've been doing for the Japanese section, one of the things that's been most rewarding is reading about, like, all these different customs and festivals that are associated with particular Shinto shrines. I don't know, I really like that. When I was running a Dogs in the Vineyard game on a play-by post on RPGNet, which tells you how long ago this is. One of the things that I did was, every time the dogs arrived in a new town, I had them arriving in the middle of something. Because this is, you know, these people don't have telegraphs, right? You ride into their town when you ride into their town. So the first time, they showed up in the middle of a wedding. The second time, they showed up in the middle of a funeral. And the third time, they showed up in the middle of a hanging. And each of those things was kind of telling them about, you know, what was going on in this town. It wasn't a wedding, it was an engagement party. Anyway, whatever. And I really would love, you know, when the characters ride into town, some festival to the gods is going on, and you're seeing, like, big bonfires have been built, and children are throwing their calligraphy into the bonfire, and the one whose paper rises the highest, you know, on the heat of the bonfire, that's the one who's going to be best at calligraphy. That's a real thing. That's fantastic. All of those little details that tell you something about the culture, right? Now we know some of the value put on calligraphy. Now we have a sense of how these acts of religious worship are integrated into people's daily lives. This type of thing is also a great way to illuminate individual characters. You know, one thing that I do in most of my games, I am a bit of a, what's the opposite of a Scrooge? Like, I'm a Christmas guy. I love Christmas. I don't know when it started. I wasn't always like this. But maybe as I, like, you know, I don't live near most of my family, and my wife and I tend to spend our Christmases just the two of us. Somehow I turned into a real jolly old Saint Nick about Christmas and, you know, hats and treats and carols and the whole bit. And most of my games tend to have a holiday special in them. This happens also in LARPs that I made, and it's great. In-character gift giving is a great way to illuminate not just the personality of the giver, but, like, what they think about the recipient. Terrific. My Brindlewood Bay game had a Secret Santa among the members of the Mystery Mavens book club. It's just all, like, all that kind of thing. Those little rites provide a social context that is external to the player character. So you don't, like, just get someone a gift as an expression of your feeling about them, although you do, but you also get it because it is understood that you give people gifts on Christmas, or whenever your cultural gift-giving moment is. And that means that players who otherwise might feel a little shy or a little reluctant about doing that, or whose characters are, like, surly jerks but not necessarily opposed to society's basic whatever, like, they can all get involved in this opportunity to display some aspect of their character's personality and maybe learn a little bit more about the game setting at the same time through the rules of the festival. If you walk into town and someone hands you, you know, a ribbon and says, all right, you know, you have to tie this ribbon on the person that you want to wed, and the last person to not have given away their ribbon gets thrown in the lake or something. I mean, I just made that up, but that's fun. Not fun in real life. super awkward in real life, but hilarious on the tabletop. I guess what I'm saying is, like most of these sections, the benefit that I got from the Japanese mythos section was that it made me read more about Japanese religion in real life, and Japanese religion in real life is absolutely chock full of gameable material. Not just the mythology, but the culture, the architecture, the art, the celebrations, I mean, everything in it. Like, I'm not saying I'm just gonna, like, my map's not gonna have a, just a kind of fantasy Japan on it, because that's, you know, I like to think I'm a little more original than that, even if only a little bit. But I'm absolutely gonna take some of those customs and filter them through the setting of my fantasy game, and I think my game's gonna be the better for it. So even a section of the book that I'm not the world's biggest fan of can point you toward something that can be really valuable, not only in, like, increasing your knowledge of things in the real world, which, if I'm going to be super boring, like, that is extremely good and valuable thing to do, but not only that, but actually also in terms of improving your game. I mean, I'm not trying to say when life gives you lemons, make lemonade, but, kind of, I guess. There's nothing that doesn't have some way to find value in it. Only problem is that sometimes the ratio of work to value is very high. But here I'm doing the work for you, so that's cool, I guess. Not that reading these sections is that challenging. I mean, it's a pretty accessible read. All right, that is about all the time that we have for this episode, and that means it's the end of the Japanese mythos section. I loved the Japanese mythology. I didn't necessarily love the Japanese mythos chapter. What else is new? I can't tell you what's going to be in our next episode because you, my listeners, haven't decided yet. So pop on over to the Patreon site and vote in that poll to determine what's going to be the next season of Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.